Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What if AI could help your business deliver mission-critical outcomes with speed? With IBM Consulting, your business can design, build, and scale trusted AI using Watson X and modernize the way you work to accelerate real impact. Let's create AI that transforms your business. Learn more at ibm.com/consulting. IBM. Let's create.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
What's up? This is Sugar Steve from Questlove Supreme. Anybody who knows this podcast is well aware that our interviews can last for hours. So often, we split them into two parts. It also gives listeners a suspenseful reason to come back next week or check their podcast feed for more episodes. Back in 2022, we sat down with L.A. Reid for what became a rare three-part interview. The third and final part of L.A. Reid's epic QLS interview covers the founding of La Face Records and some rarely discussed history surrounding Outkast and TLC. Please rate, like, and subscribe to this on your podcast feeds. Check back for new episodes and follow our new YouTube page at QLS.
At the time, in 88, 89, I wouldn't have thought, hey, Atlanta is a great place to build my empire. What did you see in Atlanta that we didn't see? Because at the time, the only artist I knew that lived in Atlanta was Peebo Bryson.
Mm-hmm. And then you changed everything. You changed the whole culture of a city.
Yeah, so why did you choose Atlanta? And how did you choose Atlanta? Why and how?
It was a combination. It was myself, Babyface, and Pebbles. All three of us were in the studio on Cahuenga Boulevard in a studio called Ilumba. And we collectively decided that we wanted to leave. We wanted to move out of LA for various reasons.
Okay. Why?
One was we're concerned about earthquakes, seriously. And that sounds kind of crazy.
Nice, it's real.
We were concerned about cost of living.
Okay.
And we had just started to make some money and we wanted to know how to stretch that, right? And so the idea was we just come off tour. Like we just finished that last tour and we've been all over the country and we didn't think LA was like the only place on earth. So we had a conversation about moving. So we put a map on the wall. We had a very serious conversation about moving.
Yeah, I was about to say, you put a map out.
Very serious conversation. We put a map on the wall, a map of the United States. And first, we looked at everyone's hometown. Where should we go? Should we go to the Bay Area where Pebbles is from?
Oh, nah. I thought she was from Atlanta. Damn.
No, she's from the Bay. We were like, nah.
Wow.
We took Indianapolis where Babyface is from.
Nah.
Cincinnati where I'm from. Mm-mm. Nah. Then we were like, New York.
Nah.
And then Kenny, we thought about our experiences being in New York and writing. And we were like, nah, we don't write that well in New York. Nah, we got it. Dallas, big homes, big, great lifestyle. One of us, and I don't remember who, said Atlanta. And all I remember, all of us saying, yes! Because Atlanta, if you're on tour, when you go through Atlanta, that's like the Mecca, right? Everything was like upscale. It was like, everything from the
pre-Olympics.
Oh yeah, this was in 88.
This is 88.
Yeah, I mean, Olympics. They didn't even have skyscrapers.
I mean, you guys and Bobby Brown, I'll never understand. Like,
we all went together.
Why would y'all do that?
We picked Atlanta because we knew we could live well. I'm being honest, right? We just knew we could live. We went down, looked at some houses, and the house prices, the real estate prices, like, we were like, we can live well down here. This place is dope. So I called Irving Azoff, who was running MCA at the time, who we thought we were going to make the LaFace deal with. And I said, Irving, I have an idea. He said, what's the idea? I said, how's this sound? Motown of the South,
ooh,
LaFace Records, Atlanta, Georgia. And he said, where do I sign? And that's how it started. And he gave us the seed money to move, book the planes, book the hotels, found us a lawyer, found us a real estate agent. And we went down and we literally stayed there until we found homes.
And where did Clive Davis come in the picture?
Irving quit. Irving's quit working at MCA.
Oh.
He left the company, right? So enter Clarence Avant.
Yes, Godfather.
So Clarence Avant, who'd always been there,
right.
Clarence says, well, if you're not doing it with Irving, then I'm going to introduce you to Jerry Moss, David Geffen, and all of the various players. And we met everybody, and everybody was interested. Mo Austin, we met everybody.
How did you get out the contract, though? You signed on the dotted line, no?
No, we didn't sign anything. We just got a producer advances. Because we made all of our hits at MCA, so we had a lot of money in the pipeline. So he just basically gave us the money that we were owed.
And you didn't have to recoup it back or repay it back or anything?
We never signed one thing. No.
Wow.
No, we didn't sign anything. We just, and it was a lot of money, you know, especially at that time.
I can imagine. Yeah.
You know, so Clarence introduced us to everybody. And when I was 18 years old, I read this book by this great record executive named Clive Davis.
The Yellow Book.
I don't even know why, 18, 19 years old, why am I reading about a record executive? I didn't even know why. But there was a photo of him sitting at the Beverly Hills Hotel pool with Sly and the family, with Sly Stone. And I was like, I want to be that guy, right? Not Sly, I want to be the guy sitting next to Sly, right? So this is my big opportunity to meet the great Clive Davis. And Clarence set it up. We walked into the bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel to meet Clive Davis. And my mind was already made up. I was like, I'm doing this with Clive. But I couldn't say that. I couldn't play. I couldn't show the hand. And I didn't actually know how Face felt about it at the time. You know, I knew Face really wanted to work on Whitney. So it just all felt right. We thought we were going to do it with David Geffen, who said yes to our deal. And then he came back and said, actually, no, I don't want to do it. And his reasoning was, I'm not committed to the genre. It wasn't bad at all. It was very honest. He was like, I'm a rock guy.
I say, yeah, he ain't waste your time.
He didn't waste that time. He's like,
that's funny, Amir.
Damn right he wasn't, because we were just his guinea pigs.
That's what I was thinking. I was like,
oh, wow. Now I'm just thinking like, wow, I could have signed to a label. I could have signed to LaFace. In 1993, Wendy Goldstein had just went to, like, I'm now imagining the alternate lifetime where Outkast needs help and the Roots are the ones.
Oh, my
that
God.
Are like, and the Roots are the ones.
That
are oh, that's hot. That's wow. Actually really hot. Wow. That's hot. Man. That's hot.
Man, I have I have a very specific Outkast question. So I want you to talk about the differences in working with between Dre and Big Boy. I really study Big Boy, is somebody that I really look at, and I look at a lot of the moves in his career, and they seem to be a direct reflection of you know his relationship with you. So I want to know, he's always spoken very highly of you,
man,
and
I love him
stuff,
so much,
you know what I mean? Yeah, so like, how's that relationship between those two guys over the years, how's that developed?
It's always been really good. And the truth is, I think it might have been one of my better relationships because I didn't know their music as well. Like I couldn't tamper. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like if TLC makes a record, I have a very strong opinion about it. Or anybody, you know, Usher makes a record, I have a very strong opinion about it. But with Outkast, they were such originals that if they felt passionately about it, my job was to be a servant leader instead of being instead of meddling.
I have a question. Okay, am I the only one that thinks this, Fonte? As much as I love elevators.
Okay.
Dude, in 1996, to make your first single, a very slow tempo song that's like 88 BPMs, not conducive to what I believe dance culture was in.
But that was in the South, though.
Atlanta. Like,
that was,
yeah,
that was
Atlanta.
A risky song. Right. That was such a risky song, yo.
In the South for us, man, that was it wasn't risky for us. We ran the fuck out of elevators, like, immediately.
Because when I got that, like, by that point, I was like getting serviced by DJs and whatnot. And yes, as a Northeasterner, like, I was in the groove of where hip hop was in that period between like 92 BPMs and 100 BPMs, like very fast pit. And when I put elevators on, I just stared at the record like, yo, this is so slow and spacey. Slow. How am I going to make this work in my DJ sets? And yet y'all went with it. Like, there was no fear whatsoever.
I actually didn't know one way or another. Like, to be honest with you, right? Andre and Big Boy and Rico Wade, they came to the office and they were like, this is it, this is it, this is it. And I knew Andre. What I did know is that Andre verse was, we all knew that. I mean, that was like, seriously, like, damn, he's good. He's really good. But as a song, I probably had the same opinion you did. I was like, this is a little slow. It's not that clear either, you know, like it wasn't sparkling. It was dark, right? And so I had the same, but I really believed in Rico Wade. Like, Rico Wade was the leader, and he was my ears, man, my eyes and my ears to everything that we were doing in that world of Outkast, the Goody Mob, and even, you know, Parental Advisory is?
Yes.
You
know,
oh, yeah, PA, absolutely.
PA, right? Yeah, yeah. They were in the crew as well. So I just listened to Rico, and it worked. And after it worked, my relationship with them was, you guys make your own decisions. If you want my opinion, I'll give you my opinion, but I'm not giving you my opinion unless you ask me. Yeah.
Is that still your relationship with Big Boy now? Because y'all still, like, work. It's
to
still,
this day.
To this day, that's how y'all do.
I do what he says. Man.
Okay, so without Rico's presence on speaker box, how do you trust your instincts? I mean, by this point, they're now a marquee act. They're your A-listers. And without the muscle of organized noise sort of under them, I mean, even though they're there somewhat, how shaky was it to navigate a double album of clearly two different sides,
right?
And not only make it work, but make it one of their most and to take them on stage. I was there that night. I couldn't believe that shit. How hard, not hard, or how worrisome were you to, like, go with your gut being the, I'm assuming that you're now manning the ship for at least that album, that you didn't have Rico there to guide you,
right? So things that kind of changed, they really grew into their, they really had grown into it. I mean, this was after Stankonia, right? And which was a massive success for them. And I mean, the real story was, it was Big Boy's solo album, right? And it was complete. And it was done. And I heard, I Like the Way You Move. So I felt confident that we had like a big single. And Andre called, because they weren't working together. This is fairly common knowledge, I think. Yeah, they weren't working together. And Andre called the office. Reed, when are you dropping Big Boy's album? I gave him the date. He's like, so if I want to drop an album with that, how much time do I have? And I think I told him, you got 3 weeks. He was like, 3 weeks. Okay.
What?
Wait. So
we don't know.
And he
this
came
story.
Back with the love.
What was he in the process? What happened? Okay. Songs.
I didn't know what he had recorded, because he wasn't really talking about it at all. He wasn't talking about making a record. Big Boi was gone solo. We've already done a photo shoot. We've picked the single. We've put the date on the calendar. We're moving forward. And then I get that call from Andre, and he says, you know, how much time do I have? And that was the first time I had an indication that he wanted to make an album. We had not talked about it at all. And I told him 3 weeks, and I just remember him saying, okay. And he hung up.
He was probably done already.
It had to be.
All I remember is that on the night that we had to, like, turn the album in for parts so we could manufacture. Andre has studios going everywhere. He had mastering going on. He had a couple of mix rooms going on. He had an ensemble of studios going to make the deadline. He was working his ass off. I went to the studio to visit and heard some of the material, but he finished it and sat down and played it for me. And I could not believe what I was hearing, man. And he played me Hey Ya. And I was like, oh my God. And I didn't try to go into the like, okay, yeah, this is a smash. That wasn't how I reacted. I was more blown away that you actually did this in 3 weeks. And I felt like you did, like, you must have had this. There's no way you did this in 3 weeks.
Yeah, he did.
Fonte has a theory, though. When Pete Rock was telling the story of how he made Public Enemy shut him down in 10 minutes. And one of y'all said, like, because of the pressure, like, he didn't have time to overthink it.
You're not thinking it. You're just doing. Yeah. That's also Quincy. He tells about the alpha state. Like, he talks about that, just recording.
Paralysis through analysis.
Yeah. Just going. You're not thinking about it. You're just creating.
That's right.
You were presented with this scenario twice. And I always wanted to know, how far did TLC get and going with that initial thing where I believe Lisa suggested all three of us should make solo records? And
not very far.
Okay.
Honestly, not very far at all. Because T-Boz had made a couple of solo songs that for a soundtrack. I gotta remember the soundtrack.
The Kids Think. It was the Touch Myself record.
I Touch Myself. That's the song. Right.
That was. Yep. I remember that. Yeah.
Oh, I was thinking about the that Rugrats thing, but
no, that would have been after. But okay. So she did it, and it was pretty clear to me that it was the ensemble that was the magic, right? And I love T-Boz. Like, I mean, I love all of them, but I had a particular love for her style, that raspy voice, she kind of approached it like a guy. She was the only girl I've seen approach it like a guy, but I thought she was so dope. But it was the ensemble that was the real winner there. And then Lisa made a solo album before she passed away. May she rest in peace. I miss her so much. She made a solo album, and I wasn't blown away by it. I didn't think it was incredible at all, you know. And it was the kind of music I should have loved it if it were good. It wasn't like outside of my thing. The way I sort of describe Goody Mob as outside of my thing. So I got to defer to them. This wasn't outside of my sweet spot, but I just didn't think it was great. And Chili never actually tried to make a solo record that I can remember until many, many years later. So that one didn't go very far.
How did you balance, you know, a record like Crazy Sexy Cool, where it's on your label, but you're also writing and producing?
I didn't write and produce
you
know, on it.
You didn't do, yeah, that wasn't you and Babyface together?
That was the last time that I was a writer producer was 7 Whole Days, Toni Braxton.
Ah, okay.
That was the last time. And then I did a song that never saw the light of day with Elton John that Elton called and asked me to produce, right? And it was for a Curtis Mayfield tribute record. Wasn't commercial at all.
Elton was spending time in Atlanta for a minute. I was like, were you the reason that Elton was spending time?
A lot. But I stopped. I stopped. And Kenny and I stopped working together. And I started spending too much time on the phone. I was transitioning into being an executive. I was learning how independent promotion worked. I was learning how marketing worked. And I was so intrigued with the stuff I didn't know. And people were coming in and telling me about like Janet Jackson's marketing plan. I was like, what's a marketing plan? So I became curious about everything. And I was hearing words like, they shipped 100,000. What's that mean, shipped 100,000? I just became curious about the business. Yeah. I think I sort of fell out of love with producing and writing. And I was never a great writer. Kenny was a great writer. I was a good producer, but Kenny was a great writer. And I was a collaborator, and I filled in some blanks and had some concepts here and there, but he was the great writer. So it was easy to sort of step back because I didn't consider myself great at it in the first place. I felt very lucky.
Yo, what's up? This is Fonte Sigolo from Team Supreme. Black representation in media is very important to me. I think it's important to have our stories told by people who look like us and who have shared in our common experiences. Some of my earliest influences were Donnie Simpson. I would also say Tom Joyner, Angela Stribling, Sherry Carter. They were just people who told our stories with a lot of class and dignity and were big inspirations to me. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black Stories, Black Truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcast, The Center Black Voices. It's NPR Noir. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get podcasts.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
So with the label, was that primarily you running the label and Face just doing the music, or was he involved on the label side as well?
No, I think if you ask him, he would say that he's always said that the label was kind of my thing. Right?
Gotcha.
Because I like the idea of signing talent and doing all that stuff, you know, and picking songs and, you know.
So for a record like A Crazy Sexy Cool, where, you know, Babyface is doing like a Dig It on You or whatever, right?
Yes.
Is there no conflict of interest?
I actually had all of the producers competing and they didn't really know it. Like I had Dallas working on it first. He was the architect. then I go play for Jermaine Dupri and be like, I know you could beat this. And then I get a squeeze. And then then Kenny is competitive. You don't have to put a battery in Kenny's back. He's so competitive. So he sent his songs in. And then I went to Rico Wade last and said, here's what everybody else gave me. What you got? And he came up with Waterfalls.
Wow.
I love it.
So according to executives at Arista, outside of Outkast, they considered Crazy Sexy Cool my first time as an A&R executive. That I wasn't the writer, I wasn't the producer. So if it was my first, I didn't see it that way, but if it was, I did okay.
With no input from Clive at all, like,
Clive, not once it was done, Clive had opinions about the singles, and we had, you know, Creep was the first single. I love Creep, by the way.
Man, but, listen, that should still go off.
So we shot a video for Creep. Wasn't very good.
Huh?
Like, damn. So we shot a second video for Creep.
Oh.
Again, wasn't very good. I'm like, fuck, now I'm in
Wait,
trouble.
Wait, what?
Yeah, we shot two videos and they weren't good. The world never saw them.
Yeah.
And so I was embarrassed, so I switched singles. I said, Creep's no longer the single. We're going to go with this song called Kick Your Game that Jermaine Dupri did. Clive was like, hold it. Why are you changing like, singles? What is this? What's behind this? You have to explain, right? And Dallas Austin called like, yo, I know you're not like not putting my single out. Like he knew he had a great record. Uh-huh. And so I had to come clean and say, well, truth be told, like I made two horrible videos and I'm just too embarrassed to tell everybody. So Clive says, get it right. He said, get it right. So I'm sitting with Diddy one day at the Helmsley Palace Hotel in New York. I'm sitting with Diddy. I play him the TLC video that's not good. And he looks at me and is like, oh my God, like, dude, this is horrible. And he does not make me feel any better about it, right? But while I'm showing him the video on one television, because I used to have this road case that I carried around with speakers and monitor mm-hmm. and everything,
of
like office in a case, I was extra. While I'm playing it for him, on the television, there's a video with In Vogue and Salt-N-Pepa called What a Man, What a Man.
What a Man.
And Matthew. I look at that video. It looks way better than our video. I'm like, who directed that? It's Matthew Rawston.
Yeah.
So I called Matthew Rawston and I asked him to do Creep. And we got it right the third time. But we threw two videos away to get to the good one.
I will do anything to find those original videos.
In a situation like that, though, when TLC got to repay the money back, do they got to pay for all three of those versions or do they just pay for the one that made it?
Well, let's look at it like this. We sell 10 million albums.
Okay, they don't. Okay.
There you go, sir. Right.
I don't know. If you want the truth, I don't know.
I love it. That's all I wanted to hear.
That's how
fine.
I got my
that
ass in trouble because I didn't know.
But you,
like,
you know what?
I'm so busy like, trying to make the great record, trying to make the great video. I'm spending people's money and not realizing it. You know?
I'm seething with anger because to sit in the Geffen offices and be told your videos are one and done. Like there is no going back. I can't believe that I'm hearing stories of
everything
didn't like
happens
the video,
for a reason. It's okay.
So we'll take
Amir.
It back. And then we'll take it back again. And then we'll take it back. I hear Mariah made four videos for Vision of Love. And I'm like,
that's a very old school thing though, man.
No,
like, that's
but
so
I mean,
old.
Just our label convinced us that like, cause we hated our videos. And
Wow. Like, literally and you couldn't do anything about it.
Yeah. Like you were stuck. Either video or no video, like, oh my God.
Those Roots videos weren't too memorable.
That's why I hate making videos. Weird enough then, that.
She's being mean to you.
No,
your videos are not too memorable. That's mean.
Listen.
Say that.
The reason that I am here is because I'm the Roots largest fan. So I can say a couple truthful things. I'm here because
the truth. You know I'm neither not bothered either way.
No.
So, okay, I was always curious. I had the call the night that Left Eye burnt the house down. Like, were you worried? Not worried about stopping the bag, but.
It was morning, first of all. It was early morning.
Oh, wow.
It was early morning. We lived
that
in the same
like a nighttime crime, not a daytime crime.
No, we lived in the same subdivision. We both lived in Country Club of the South. My housekeeper at the time was taking my son Aaron. She was taking him to school. He was in the kindergarten.
All right.
And or maybe preschool, but and she called. I want to say, I don't know if Pebbles was not home or I don't know for whatever reason I answered the phone. She said, I just drove by. Lisa's house is on fire. So I look outside. I see helicopters swarming. I'm like, oh, shit. So I just start trying to find Lisa. I just start trying to find her. And I found her, right? I called every number I had, everybody I knew. And I found her. And she said she was okay. She said she didn't get hurt. She was okay. And she told me it wasn't on purpose. It was an accident. And I immediately went to protect her. And I had friends in the police force there, like the chief of police was a friend. And I just asked him, like, can you just help me to protect her? Like, I don't want her to be arrested. I don't want anything to happen. So he helped me. We gave her an entire floor at the Swiss Hotel in Buckhead. And with police, and no one could get on the floor. And she stayed there until she had to go to court for it. And then, you know, but yeah, I didn't think about anything except her safety.
Okay. 94, 95, especially 96, 97 is probably one of the most tumultuous times in Black exec.
Yes.
And, you know, all right. The thing is that we lived in Europe during this time period. So we really were sort of out of the literal crossfire.
You lived in Europe at the time?
The shortest story is that basically we realized Richard Nichols was intuitive enough to the day that, God rest his soul, Kurt Cobain committed suicide. Rich said the label's going to drop us because by this point Aerosmith had went to Sony, Guns N' Roses wasn't coming up with another album, and now Nirvana's gone. And literally, like, those three acts and all the billions that they made enabled Geffen to have a Black department. And we were their first act. And Rich sort of had the spidey sense that everybody's going to get the axe. So we better just grab our publishing money, run to Europe, get a flat, and then just become, like, the Black version of the Commitments. Like, get a tour bus and just tour all over Europe. So we just lived there for, like, 3 years straight working. So we were really, we hadn't met none of our peers, none of that stuff. Like, we come back to record new albums, see our families, but for the most part, it's like 6 months touring in Europe and spot dates like all over the United States touring. But for the most part, we had missed a lot of the stories that we heard between, like, what was the trouble brewing between, like, executives, and you knew how toxic that environment was. How frightening was it being a Black executive? And more important, how did you avoid getting sucked into just the toxicness of it all, where beef is now like a regular thing between executives, you know?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have to tell you, like, I was really concerned. I was really concerned about it. And because I was very close to Puffy, right? And I helped start Bad Boy. You know, I helped get him the deal for Bad Boy. And I'm very proud of that, by the way, because I actually wanted him to be an A&R guy at LaFace. And after one meeting, I realized that this is nobody's employee. This guy's special, you know.
Right.
And yeah, I was concerned about it, man, because I felt like Atlanta wasn't the East or the West. So we were weren't viewed as the competition for either the East or the West, right? Whatever we were doing in Atlanta, even though, like, we were having hits, but culturally, the impact of the West Coast was really huge, right? With Snoop and Dre and Pac and all of that. And then the Bad Boy on the East Coast, those things were, like, very front facing. And what we did at LaFace wasn't as front facing. Like our artists were, but Kenny and I weren't like that. We weren't, there was right. no chain. There was no, you know, we weren't like that, you know, so.
But I can only imagine that the more success you got, the more it puts you out front to become sucked into that. Because yeah. I don't think that there would be a Bad Boy Death Row thing if Puffy were releasing records produced by me. I mean, not to be self-deprecating, but I'm just saying that obviously there's a competition thing on what label's going to wind up on top. And right. you're actually selling more units than both those labels, at least for their right. artists alive.
Right, you know? Right, right.
I mean, you could have been an easy target.
I was avoiding it, man, as best I could. And I knew everybody. I mean, I seriously.
So you have relations with Suge and you have a relationship with Puffy and.
Yes, yes. And I did not know Biggie and I did not know Tupac, right? I can't say I knew either of them. I probably had a one handshake with each person and a sort of passing, but I didn't know them. Yeah, so I tried hard, and I won't kid you, I am nobody's tough guy. I tried desperately to avoid ever being in the room. I wouldn't even go to the
So would
fights.
You go to Jack the Rappers and all those things?
Before I would, but there was
Were
a time
Were they important?
When,
was that important to go to, or was that just a vanity thing?
You know what, it was important because all the DJs were there. Like all the DJs, and at that time, DJs could make a decision about which records they played, right? Before the conglomerates took over, you know, yeah. DJs had some say. They had a say in what they played. And so we did, and all of the labels' competitors were there. You got a chance to see what the other label had, what they had coming. And if you needed to go back and do better or find another song or find another act. So, and it was good. Camaraderie. It was really good until it wasn't. When it got bad, it got bad. And that's when I stopped going, you know. But I just tried to avoid it, man, and just stay to myself as much as I could and trying to sort of diminish my presence, as crazy as that sound, right? I didn't want to be, you know, we didn't even have photos. We didn't take pictures of nothing. We just stayed in the background as much as we could.
Was there an act that you kind of purposely passed on signing just because, like, this might cause smoke for the label? Or
probably. Like, I don't remember a name, but I didn't actively look for artists in New York and L.A. I really didn't. I ain't even gonna lie, right? I did not actively look. And so I was getting Chattanooga, Tennessee, Atlanta, Georgia, you know, you know what I mean? Des Moines, Iowa.
Speaking of Chattanooga, Tennessee, can we finally settle this once and for all? Can you please tell us the Can We Talk story? Right.
No, I saw what Tevin said. I never had a say in that because Kenny wrote that song and he produced it on Tevin Campbell. And that was it. Like, there was never like a conversation like, should we give it to Usher or should I? There was never a conversation. Kenny and I were not working as writer producer partners at that moment. That he did completely on his own and gave it to Tevin. Tevin sang the hell out of it and it worked. So there was never any back and forth.
So you never had a Dick Griffey moment where like LaFace gave a song to someone that you know you could have used that song for your artist, and it's like, yo, come on, dog, like I could have used that. I asked you last week if you had something for TLC, and you said no.
No, it wasn't really like that. And I was also very clear about Kenny's ambitions as a writer, right? Kenny wanted the greatest artists possible to sing his songs. And it wasn't about it for him. It was never about whether it was on LaFace or whether it was on Arista or Epic, or he never thought about it that way. He thought about it as like the song Girlfriend that Pebbles got. The reason she got it is because he thought her voice was the right voice for the song. It was originally for Vanessa Williams. Mm-hmm. Right. And he thought, he said, it's not right for Vanessa, because he listened to as a musician, as an artist, as a writer, producer, he listened to the voices and he made his decisions based on the voices. And how do you argue with that?
There's definitely a big difference between the Pink that signed to LaFace first few records and the artist that she morphed into. So how, what's the conversation and the metamorphosis where, you know, there's a beginning and then there's definitely a separation from what she was. And you're part of that process. So like,
yes.
At what point do you realize maybe I should loosen the strings somewhat and see where they go with it?
Right. So first album, she did that album as a member of the group Choice. And then they disbanded and we continued the process. And some of the songs that were made for Choice, she kept them. But we struggled in the beginning. We really struggled because she was still growing. She was very young and she was still finding herself, finding her style. And so we, the first album, we did the best we could do, right? It was called Can't Take Me Home. Loved her concepts, loved her, how she thought about it. And I loved her voice and her energy. She was incredible. Musically, it was a little bit undefined and all over the place. When it got to, so, but we had a hit with There You Go. Mm-hmm. And she had a second hit called Most Girls. Not as big a hit, but it did really well. So when it came to her second album, she hooked up with Dallas Austin. Her and KP basically oversaw it. And then she hooked up with Linda Perry. And when she first brought it to me, I was like, wait a minute, you're abandoning like the urban thing that you started on your first album. Mm-hmm. Are you sure about that? And she was like, yeah, I'm not trying to repeat that. I'm on to something really special. And I was like, okay, I don't know. I was like, I'll tell you what, if you feel passionately about it, I'm going to step back, do your thing, right? And my exact words to her were, because I got this from Dick Griffey. I said, I'm going to give you an opportunity to fail.
Never obtain yourself, okay.
Yeah, I said that. And I didn't really know what it meant. But I said it because Dick Griffey said it. Anyway, and so she did it. She came back and she played me Get the Party Started, 18 Wheeler. And she played me all those songs. And I was like, oh, my God, this girl's made a real album. Mm-hmm. And we went to work, hooked her up with Dave Myers. They made a great video and she was off to the races. After that, when it came to her third album, I wasn't involved at all. I wasn't involved at all. She got a new manager, Roger Davis, very famous manager who also manages Tina Turner.
Yeah, Roger Davis.
So her and Roger kind of, they did it all and just turned it in. Like I wasn't involved at all. And when it was done, I didn't think it was particularly good, honestly. And I left the company right as it was time to release it. So, and it didn't do that great.
I don't understand when LaFace just amalgamates into Arista, but do I recall when you actually went back to school?
I did.
Because Swizz did the same thing. Like, what is this?
Yeah, I did. So what happened is I got contacted by the Bertelsmann, the company that owned Arista.
BMG, yeah.
Mm-hmm, BMG. The head of BMG visited me, came to Atlanta, visited me. This was early too, man. This was like probably 94. And that early on, they said, we want you to prep yourself because at some point we want you to take over Arista Records. And I was like, yeah, right. That's what I thought to my, I didn't even believe it, 94. Okay, so a couple of years go by, and they call again. And instead, this time they don't say Arista. They said, we would like for you to go back to school. We'd like you to go to school. We can get you enrolled in a program at Harvard. You'll have to go and stay on campus. You got to stay for 10 weeks. You cannot run the company. You can't talk to your artists. You can't talk to executives. You can talk to your family. but we need you on the campus and we need you to put in 50 to 60 hours a week doing case studies and living on the campus and really studying international business.
Wow.
Okay.
It's like a jail sentence.
I like the idea of it because I didn't go to college and I regret it not going to college because I opted to be a musician. I opted to go on the road. That was college to me. So I liked this idea. So I went and I stayed there for my 10 weeks and it was really hard because it was really, really hard. So I got kids on campus to tutor me and help me get through it. And I made friends with other people that were in my dorm. So it was like the students were teaching each other.
So you really had to go to Harvard and stay at Harvard and you had to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I lived on campus and I live in Atlanta. I'm a musician, half musician, half executive. You know, I'm a hybrid. I'm a very weird hybrid. I don't know how to dress. I don't know how to walk. I don't know how to talk. I don't know which handshake to use. I'm like completely confused. I'm a fish out of water in the greatest institution in the world, apparently, right? So it was very intimidating. Everybody seemed so smart. I mean, the accents, and you know, when you hear guys with Indian accent talking about EBITDA, it sounds smarter, you know, or guys from the UK, they always sound smarter than we do, right? So it's just all very intimidating. And then I found my groove right around halfway point. I started to find my groove and figured it out. And at the end of it, I graduated and I didn't know if I would.
What were some of the things you learned from that program? Like, how did that
benefit? We really studied businesses. We studied things like things that you would love. Like we studied decisions that Phil Knight made to make Nike a success. We discovered, gotcha, you know, things like that. Like, and we would take it in steps. Like they would present us a case. They would show us the dilemma or where the company could go one way or another. And then they would test us basically like, what decision would you make here? And then we would go to the next sort of chapter of the story. And it was just basically case studies, studying each person's case, not only in entertainment, but or in apparel, but everything from public utilities to, you know, hospital to grocery stores to automotive, Toyota, to Disney. We studied businesses.
There's, of course, a famous book out now called The Harvard Report, where they first did a case study of Clive Davis.
Yes.
Embracing Black music. Were they still using that book as a?
No, we never got there. But they have so many, like they collect case studies from all over the world. And each professor would select the cases that he wants to use in his classrooms. But there's no set stories. I knew about the Clive. They actually did one with me about it was like the study of Black music. Right. They did. I know a lot of people that they've actually done the reports. They don't publish them all. They don't actually use them all, but they just basically collect information and they teach it. And it's good. The way we went about it, like, it was intimidating at first until I got my groove and realized that there were things I knew that some of the people in the room didn't know.
Yeah.
Once I got that confidence, I was like, okay.
Because they study in business, but you've been running one.
Yes.
All right, y'all, you know what season it is. Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segui, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, I have one confessions question. I kind of consider confessions the end of the parenthesis of whatever. I mean, I really can't tell like what the first mega album, maybe Carole King's Tapestry was right. Like one of the first mega selling records. But, you know, Usher's Confessions comes at a time when streaming culture is about to confuse the whole entire industry, where buying a tangible record is a vote. So this is kind of a part one and part two thing. When Confessions was said and done, did you realize then that there will never be another mega selling album of this nature again in the music business?
Wow. No. I didn't think of that. That's incredible that you should say that, but no.
Yeah,
well,
Confessions is the, like, after that, then.
That's the last, like, diamond album?
Yes. Literally.
Damn.
Because after that, streaming comes in and ruins it. But I was asking that only because of his Atlanta roots. I always wanted to ask a CEO at least what their feelings of what streaming was threatening to be. And of course, you know, there's the Napster situation that sort of confused people and had them in their feelings. And then accepting iTunes and whatnot, even down to DJ Drama's arrest. Like, can you talk about what the at least the scary environment for what music was about to become? Now, somehow you managed to.
There was a piece in between that, which was downloads. And downloads, while they weren't physical, were still a la carte. They were still like sales. So the next chapter of successes were measured through downloads, right? Some physical, not that much, you know, but CDs were dwindling badly. Vinyl was completely out of the count. And downloads were the thing. So we still had.
But as president, did you feel the pressure that I got to figure out something quick? Like my artists went from 10 million to now to sell 3 million is an achievement. Although it's not your fault per se, it's just
right,
where the
times
are going.
Yeah.
How are you dealing with that as a CEO, like, and as an executive?
Yeah, the idea was just to not bottom out. The idea was, yes, the sales are dwindling and it's across the board. It's not one company that's dwindling. It's not one artist that sales are dwindling. The entire industry is going down the tube. Napster's introduced the download. So we're fighting piracy at a rate that we've never had to fight piracy, at least that we know of. So with that being the reality, it was just get the best artists and the best records you can and do the best you can. And I never really measured it against, like, I didn't even know that fact. I didn't know that Confessions, like, was maybe the last diamond. I didn't even know that.
Confessions and Speaker Box were the last of the Mohicans.
The last. Like, I didn't even realize that. So I didn't, in my mind, compete with it. I didn't think of it that way. I thought of it more as meaningful bodies of work, like which I felt Kanye made as an example, right? And I was really proud of everything for the time I was around him. I was proud of those records, and I felt that they were, I felt they measured up to whatever we did at with Outkast, whatever we did with Usher. And I also had like Mariah Carey's Emancipation of Mimi, right? And that felt like the, for me, that felt like the follow-up to Confessions.
Right.
Some of the same kind of sounding records. That's how I looked at it. But I didn't look at the sales, and I didn't look at the challenge that we had as an industry as a threat. I looked at it more as, yes, we need to figure this out. And
once you come to Def Jam, like, you kind of have to start all over again. Like, what is it to meet your, especially coming from where they came from, as far as like the era of Julie and Lior.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Like, to come in there and to be the new guy, like, was it dealing with side eyes and no?
Oh my God, man, it was crazy. It was crazy.
Tracy Waples was nice to you?
Tracy wasn't there when I got there.
Okay.
She came once Jay was president, right? But man, it was scary because it was a real, first of all, I didn't realize, here's the thing about Def Jam. Like, if you're a part of that culture, you realize how important that culture is. If you're not a part of it, you don't really know. So as crazy as this sounds, I didn't know that it was what it was. Like, it wasn't that to us in Atlanta. I mean, it was a successful company. It was big. We respected it. We knew Russell. We knew Rick Rubin. We knew Lyra Cohen. We knew Chris Lighty. We knew LL Cool J. We knew it, but we didn't think of it as the institution that it was. We didn't see it that way. So when I walked in, I was shocked by it all. I was shocked by the voice of the community and their opinions about anything that happened. I didn't realize that Def Jam belonged to the streets. It belonged to the people. Like, you know, Funkmaster Flex had a say in it. I'm just making up names. Anybody, right? Everybody had a say in it. So when I came in as a new chairman of the company, coming from my background, I was immediately made to feel uncomfortable, right? Executives were taking out articles in the newspaper and in Billboard magazines, talking about how I wasn't fit for it and how, you know, how would I know how to go talk to DMX? Like, you know, it was, and I felt it. I really did. I felt it. And I didn't feel welcome at all. And I loved Julie. I think she's one of the most remarkable executives in the world. I love Kevin. I think he's one of the most remarkable executives in the world. Neither of them made me feel welcome.
Kevin and Julie were still there when you came?
Yes.
Oh, I kind of thought they all left together.
Yeah, they were there when I got there. Only Lior had left. And I didn't feel very welcome, right? And
I get it.
And I didn't feel welcomed by the artist either. The artist at that time, you know, I loved them, right? Method Man, Redman, Ghostface, LL Cool J. The only one, and Jay-Z was like on semi-retirement.
Right.
Rockefeller. And the artist that embraced me was Kanye West.
Wow.
That was the one that embraced me, right?
So that helps.
That helped a lot. And this is early Kanye before he released his first album, right? Although it was already done and slated to be released when I came to the company. But I met him and he said to me, because you understand Outkast, you'll probably understand me. And that was the first conversation we ever had. And I locked in with him. And then Mariah called. And because her and I wanted to work together for years, I tried to sign her at Arista when she first left Sony. And so I had Mariah embracing me, but no one else. So Mariah says, I'm on the phone with Mariah. This is really good. She says, you know how you can put the fire out? I was like, how? She said, make Jay-Z the president.
Oh, man, no.
That was Mariah. You don't like that idea?
No, well, you asking the wrong person.
She's being overprotective.
I was way overprotective of the Roots. I had a whole conversation with Jay on the radio about the way he was handling his presidency and the way he was handling all the Philadelphia acts at the time. So no, as a radio person and for the Philadelphia person, I was not feeling that. But the artist, he's great.
Oh yeah, okay.
Anyway,
but you know what? When Mariah put the idea in my head. Mm-hmm. I presented it to Jay. Didn't get an answer right away. Eventually we were able to come to terms and he became the president of Def Jam, and at that point that made the peace and everybody left me alone. And
wow. Method Man wasn't happy. Ghostface wasn't happy.
That's something I did not know. Wow.
Yeah. And a lot of the artists, like I met a few artists that have said to me that they, because it's a two-way street. When you become, you're the head of a label and you come in to an established company, you're auditioning for them. Mm-hmm. It's not right. The other way around. It's not the artists need to prove to you. It's you need to prove to the artists, right?
Right.
And many of the artists were like, we're not even going to give you a chance because A, we think you might be R&B. B, we think you pop. Either way, we don't think you're hip hop. So I'm not even coming to your office, right? So that was a very difficult thing. And I was like, yo, okay, I hear y'all. I still have the biggest selling hip hop album of all time. Yeah. Do I get a meeting? Cause y'all ain't beat the speaker box love below yet. So can I at least get a meeting?
I can't even believe that you would have to beg for a meeting. That's crazy.
I was not embraced. It's okay though. Like, I'm not saying that, like, I was cool. And I just embraced those that embraced me. And we created a different kind of label. As Chris Lighty, may he rest in peace, loved him. He said, this is LaFace Jam. This is not Def Jam.
Wow. One very unusual Def Jam signing at the time that I considered. Can you talk about what it took to market and break Justin Bieber?
Oh, yes. So I love that. That was a gift from Usher, right? Mm-hmm. Usher came in. He said, "I have a gift for you." He came in. I thought he was going to bring me cigars or wine or something.
I love this story. I love this story. Yes, of white men. I love it.
That was a gift.
Yes.
And he walks in with 14-year-old Justin Bieber. Justin comes in and he's beating on the table, right? And he's playing the piano, he's playing the guitar, and he's singing, he's jumping around, he's talking, he's a mile a minute. And I'm just staring at him like, this star. Like, I got my star hat on. I'm like, this dude is mm-hmm. the star. I'm telling you guys, I ain't gonna lie. I thought I'd met Elvis.
Wow.
Wow. I was like, this dude right here. Because the girls all talked about how pretty his face was. Not pretty like in a negative way, but in a way that they loved him, right? All the girls loved him. Mm-hmm. And then many artists kind of liked him. And so we went about making the record. And the first record, with strategy, you want to do strategically? I have this theory that Blue Eyed Soul is the music that has the greatest opportunity for global success. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
So we put him on Black Radio. First thing out, put him on V103 in
Baby
Atlanta. That's where it started. He had a song called One Time before Baby.
Okay.
And we put it on V103 and that's what we did, man. We went black first.
Mm-hmm.
And then we put it on rhythm and then we crossed it over. But we wanted to give him some black foundation. And he had the check, the endorsement because of Usher, and me. So he had real and Dream and Tricky were making his records. So he was covered.
Which he could have went the other way, because wasn't it a battle between Usher and, was it Justin?
Justin Timberlake.
Yes, yeah. They both wanted him.
It was. They both wanted him.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, Kanye embraced him, you know, and it just kind of worked out.
Everyone fell in line.
Drake, everybody else, yeah.
All right, I'm going to slowly wind this down.
Okay.
And I can't believe that at this point, oh my God, this is like the old school. This is near 4 hours.
Yeah, we're knocking on four.
This might be three episodes.
My sister just smiled when you said we're gonna wind this down.
Yeah, yeah, I seen her walk past about 3-4 times. Like, I'm just saying, hey, I ain't saying.
I mean, at this rate where you've worked at labels and whatnot, do you believe in the theory that I hear people say all the time, like, it's going to be the end of labels, no more labels? If it is going to be the end of labels, what will happen to music next? Because I do feel like something is going to eventually give. Like, I feel like this decade that we're in, the 20s, everything is giving. So should music follow suit? Are you prepared to aid in the next step of it, or is it sort of like, all right, I've done my bit, I'm gonna sit out?
I'm definitely not done. First of all, I ain't sitting out nothing, man. They tried to take my head off. I still got my head. So sorry. So I don't believe in that. I think that labels have historically not been well loved, well liked. And for the right reasons, probably. But throughout time, people have not, record labels do not have a great public perception, no matter what it is, no matter, you know, culturally maybe so, like people like Def Jam or people like Bad Boy or Motown or whatever, right? But culturally, it may have a lot of impact. But the public perception are that record companies are generally not upstanding people. So people have always wanted to see the demise of record labels. I think that, and so now we live in an era of independence, right? Where, and that's good in that, and there's bad in that, right? The bad in that is that there is no barrier to entry. There is no filter. So everything is out. Everything is on Spotify. Everything is on Apple. Everything is on SoundCloud. Everything. Like, there's no filter for it, right? And so now we're leaving it to the editorial people or the music editors to make the decisions about which songs are good enough to be on the world's biggest playlist. But they're picking from 60,000 a day. Okay. I don't see that as great, right? At all, because I like the idea that tastemakers, curators of music, passionate music people make decisions about what they love based on their experiences, and those things get a shot. Not that the other things shouldn't get a shot, but I don't like the idea that it's a free-for-all. And there's a fallacy there that you can be Chance the Rapper and you can be independent and make it all the way to the top. But as I understand it, he's probably got 50 like employees and a lot of money and all kinds of stuff. That's not exactly the same thing as being just a starving kid in Columbus, Ohio, who wants to be independent, right? That's not the same thing.
He has money.
So if you're a kid, if you're a 15-year-old kid in Columbus, Ohio, and you don't have a record label, you're told to do it on your own, man, you don't know what to do. You do not know what to do, right? So that means that you're gonna put your music out. It might get wasted. You're gonna waste a lot of time. You're gonna get discouraged. And we might actually not see the next star because you've been discouraged before you get an opportunity to come out of the gate. Whereas if someone embraces you and put their arm around you and says, you know, I believe in you. And oh, by the way, I'm leaving out something very important. You're a highly trained, wildly successful, massively talented musician, and you respect people who put the time in that you put in. Whether you like their music or not like their music, you respect the fact that all of you guys are seasoned executives and seasoned professionals, and you respect people who do. There's something to be said for the people who are just doing it as a hobby, who aren't serious, who aren't as serious as you are, who aren't as talented as you are, who haven't been challenged the way you have, who have never been on stage, right? There's something to be said for the fact that we need the music infrastructure as a training ground, right? Somebody needs to know what it's like. I mean, anyway, my feelings about it are, I'm very passionate about it.
So how do we get back? Do we get back?
It's not actually gone. Okay. Record labels make more money than they ever made.
Huh. Is that true?
That's
record labels make more money than they ever made.
I truly thought that record labels were kind of on a defibrillator status.
Yeah.
No, bro. Record labels are killing it. Universal Music is worth over $50 billion, bro. A music company. I'm not talking about film or TV or tech. I'm talking about music content that you created.
Right. But right. Universal at this point owns so many properties in that way, right? Like not any, it's not as many individuals.
I mean, they've been gobbling up labels for years. But the point is that like they are making the record labels are making an absolute fortune.
Okay.
An absolute fortune. And I don't begrudge it. It's beautiful. You know, I wish I was right there getting bonuses right now. I'm not mad at it. But the point of it is that the infrastructure hasn't died. It takes a record label to say, OK, hey, Lil Nas X, that's an example. Lil Nas X, he comes out with his Old Town Road. It becomes some kind of a phenomenon independently, by the way. It gets picked up by a major label. This is an artist, like him or not. This is an artist that has a massive creative vision. Right. And it needs to have the kind of financial support that he can get that off. He can't do that independently. Those ideas are too big. Honestly, those ideas are very expensive. Otherwise, we get a fraction of who this artist could be. If he wasn't signed to Columbia Records, I'm saying that he would be a success, but he'd be a fraction of the artist that he could be because now he has the infrastructure to really get it off.
He's the artist that fits in that mold. I mean, for me, when I talk to young artists coming up, my thing is just if you're going to sign to a label, if you're going to do that, my advice is if you're going to do it, you might as well play big. You might as well swing for the fences.
Like that's the only reason to do it.
That's the only reason. If you just want to, if you're just truly an independent person, not just as a label, but just as a creator, you know what I mean? If you just want to look, I just want to do my shit when I feel like it, put it out when I feel like it. Great. But a major label is not for you. Like, that's not what that is.
Yeah, it's not for everybody. But to me, the game is not for everybody. That's what I'm trying to say is that it's not for everybody and it shouldn't be so easy to get in. It's hard. It's harder. You can't just get in the NBA because you like basketball. Right?
Can it be some gray in between what you're saying and what's going on right now? Is there more gray than you're...
Maybe, possibly. Okay. I'm open-minded. So that's quite possible. Okay. but what I am a strong advocate of is, are you serious about the game? Are you serious about this? Because I don't like the idea. Like this is not for hobbyists.
Serious don't mean what it used to mean. Serious.
I know, and that bothers me. Right.
Serious don't mean trade, reading your trades and reading all your books. It don't.
But are you the last of the Mohicans? Like, I know there's you. I know there's Sylvia. I don't know if Doug Morris is still in the game or not. But, you know, like someone else is running. I don't know who's running Def Jam now, but someone
My man Tunji.
Oh, yeah.
Tunji's running Def Jam?
Yes. And he's really talented.
Yes.
And I'm happy. I'm proud. I will support and promote and do anything. He is really talented and he's about that music. He's about culture. He's bringing African culture into the country with Afrobeat. He's looking forward and he's doing it based on talent. He's doing it based on qualification. And he's not just looking at data and saying I should sign this because it's streaming. He's looking at he's listening to the music.
And he did it with Keith Cool. It very much reminded me. His trajectory was very much like you in the sense that Keith Cool was like his LaFace. So
yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean? And then he came and they brought him in to run Def Jam. So,
Shout out to By the way, that like I don't know what the roots are exactly up to recording artist wise. If it was me. As a music curator, now Def Jam is the perfect place.
Man.
Well, guess what? you know the thing where like I don't know the movie or the sitcom example of like when you think you're like that's your last statement and you like burn the house down or like you're the father like and I'm leaving the family and you leave and then you come back cuz you forgot your keys. We just got reminded by Def Jam. Oh, by the way, I remember what we said, but you guys actually do owe us one more record. So it's like,
Tunji.
I think this is a great thing because I think that I know that he loves you. I know that he loves the Roots and understands it.
I love
and you, it's man. Also possible that he might make a suggestion or two that you might like, right? About try this or try that, right? I think it's that to me.
Literally all of his signings, I feel like, are the Roots' grandchildren. So, yes.
Children.
They are. That's what I'm trying to say. That's exactly what I'm trying to say.
Right.
That one, to me, you know, as someone you didn't ask, right? That works.
I got it.
Before we go, man, I know you got to go. I just wanted to say this, man. You played a very, and I'm so happy we're having this chance to have this conversation. You played a part in my career that I'm sure you have no idea you did. But this is back in like 2007. You had a group on Def Jam Player Circle. They were through DTP. And so my man, Denon Porter, shot him. He hit me to do some records. He was like, yo, man, I'm burnt out. I need just some hook ideas, whatever. And I was like, all right, cool, whatever. So I just referenced a couple hook ideas for him and sent them off. And I didn't think nothing else of it. And so the song that I did, it was a song called Paper Chaser. And I just sang it as a reference. And so the joint ended up, I didn't find out until like later that the song actually made the record. And so I ran into Titty and Dollar. We was at BET Awards in 07. And me and Dollar was talking, and he was like, oh my God. He was like, I was like, yo, I'm Fonte, man. He was like, oh, yo, what's up? And I'm like, what the hell? And he said, man, the thing with that record, he said, we sent it in. And he said, we was thinking about like getting Akon on it, because you know Akon was going up at that time. He was like, we was thinking about getting like Akon or somebody went on it. He said, but L.A. Reid was like, yo, who's the dude that's singing on it? I like him. Just it sound good like that. Just keep it. You know what I'm saying? And I just want to say thank you
LA
so much.
Style.
That really put really gave me just a lot of confidence and belief. I'm like, yo, this dude
a battery in your pack. Fucking,
woo!
Man, I was like, yo, like,
that's great.
Just thank you. Thank you so much for that, man. That really meant a lot.
Thank you. That's great. I'm so happy to hear that. Well, thank you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate this on behalf of Fonte.
Oh, and real quick, thank you for putting out Splacavelli by Pressure.
Yeah. And by the way, Amir, you are you're the dopest dude in this business, man. Like, I really love and appreciate you, man. Like, you make me proud to be a part of this thing.
Well, I think
you represent us well.
And I appreciate you for not dropping me on my birthday. I'll never forget.
I think, by the way, I don't think that's the truth, but I'm gonna let you have it.
Rich, that probably was Rich trying to get him to finish some shit. That was what that was.
Boy, I don't even know how you do that.
I called you on my birthday.
I remember that. Listen, I remember that. But anyway,
on behalf of Unpaid Bill and Sugar Steve, sorry, Steve, we once again hogged all your questions.
It's all good. I've been reading my recent episode of Black Beat magazine the whole time.
Yeah, you tapped out on me, Sugar. You tapped out on me, but it's all good.
All right. On behalf of Lightyear and Fontigolo and the great L.A. Reid, this is Questlove Supreme, and we'll see you on the next go-round. Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Have you ever brought your magic to Walt Disney World like, hey, we came to play? Did you tip your tiara to a Creole princess or get goofy officially? Step up like a boss and save the day? Or see what life's like under the Tree of Life? Did you? If you could, would you? When we come through, it's true magic. 'Cause we came to play. Bring the magic at Walt Disney World Resort.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.